Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is week one of our bi-weekly issue, so I'd like to read you the cover stories and the feature stories. And our cover story is Down and Out. After the 2024 fiasco, the Democrats are rethinking everything. And this is by Charlotte Alter. Like a lot of Democrats these days, Chris Murphy has been doing some soul searching. For years, the Connecticut senator, who took office shortly after the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, was one of the nation's most outspoken advocates for tighter gun laws. Gun safety was so important, he argued, that supporting an assault weapons ban should be mandatory for Democratic leaders. Recently, Murphy has come to believe he was wrong, not about tougher gun laws, but about trying to force all Democrats to adopt his position. "I bear some responsibility for where we are today," he told me in a phone interview in April. "I spent a long time trying to make the issue of gun a litmus test for the Democratic Party. I think that all of the interest groups that ended up trying to apply a litmus test for their issue ended up making our coalitions a lot smaller." Murphy's shift in thinking is part of the reckoning that has gripped the party since President Donald Trump's victory in November. Democrats could dismiss Trump's first term win as a fluke. His second, they know, was a product of catastrophic failure, a nationwide rejection of Democratic policies, Democratic messaging, and the Democrats themselves. The party got skunked in every battleground state and lost the popular vote for the first time in 20 years. They lost the House and the Senate. Their support sagged with almost every demographic cohort except Black women and college-educated voters. Only 35% of Democrats are optimistic about the future of the party, according to a May 14th AP poll, down from nearly 6 in 10 last July. Democrats have no mojo, no power, and no unifying leader to look to for a fresh start. Everyone knows how bad things are. "As weak as I've ever seen it," says Representative Jared Golden of Maine, who represents a district that Trump won. "Trump's second term is worse than everyone imagined," says Nevada Senator Jackie Rosen. The Democratic National Committee has offered few answers as it prepares to release a post-election review sometime this summer. "I don't like to call it an autopsy because our party is not dead. We're still alive and kicking," explains Ken Martin, the new party chair. "Maybe barely, but we are." You already know most of the reasons for the 2024 fiasco. Joe Biden was too old to be president, and just about everybody but Joe Biden knew it. His sheer oldness undermined all efforts to sell his policies effectively. Democrats lost touch with the working class, with men, with voters of color, and with the young. Voters saw Democrats as henpecked by college campus progressives overly focused on woke issues like diversity and trans rights. They tried to convince people that the economy was good when it didn't feel good. They tried to convince people that inflation and illegal immigration were imaginary problems. In an era when voters around the globe were in an anti-incumbent mood, Democrats were stuck defending the status quo. the pandemic election of 2020 and the post-Dobbs midterm of 2022 lulled top party officials to a dangerous complacency. They thought that Americans hated Trump enough to accept an unsatisfying alternative. They thought wrong. Over the past 2 months, I've spoken to dozens of prominent Democrats, from senators to strategists, frontline House members to upstart progressives, and activists to top DNC officials, in an effort to figure out how the party can chart its way back. I asked them all versions of the same questions. How did they dig this hole, and how could they get out of it? What ideas do Democrats stand for beyond opposing an unpopular president? How can they reconnect with the voters that they've lost? And who should be leading them, and what should they be saying? In other words, what's the plan? Many of these conversations made my head hurt. Democrats kept presenting cliches as insights and old ideas as new ideas. Everybody said the same things. Nobody seemed to be really saying anything at all. But in between feeble platitudes about showing up and listening and fighting for the working class and meeting people where they are, a few common threads emerged. The Democrats know they have a branding problem that transcends policy, messaging, and leadership questions. They largely agree that they need to re-enter economic issues in their messaging and develop what some are calling a patriotic populism to counter Trump. They need to build a bigger tent. Many moderate Democrats want to sideline the activist groups that pressured elected officials to take unpopular positions. Even many progressives are retreating from the purity politics that reigned in the Trump era. They know they need fresh ideas and new leaders, even though they can't always agree on how to find them. The intra-party squabbles between moderates and progressives that have dominated the past decade have given way to different fault lines. If you're talking about conservative or liberal or progressive or moderate, you're missing the whole effing point, says Representative Pat Ryan, who outran Kamala Harris by double digits in his purple district in New York's Hudson Valley. It's not progressive or moderate. It's status quo or change. It's for the people or for the elites. After a brutal winter, Democrats are beginning to show signs of life. The party won a crucial Supreme Court race in Wisconsin and picked up 2 seats in the Pennsylvania State House. In early April, roughly 4 million people attended more than 1,300 rallies across the United States, demanding that their leaders fight harder against Trump. The Fighting Oligarchy Tour, headlined by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has drawn hundreds of thousands of people across red states. The grassroots is sending a clear message to sitting Democrats. Do better, or we'll replace you with people who will. Most in the party recognize that this is a crisis moment. But every crisis is also an opportunity, a chance to rethink politics, reframe messaging, and recruit new leaders who can meet the moment. The last time democracy were this deep in the wilderness was in 2005, when few outside the DNC had heard of Barack Obama. The Republicans' own search for answers in the wake of Mitt Romney's 2012 defeat gave rise to Trump. When you hit rock bottom, anything is possible. And every transformative political figure of the modern age has emerged from a moment like this one. It's a sunny Tuesday in early spring, and Jake Oceanclaus is sitting on a bench outside the Rayburn House office building. Oceanclaus, a 37-year-old third-term congressman from Massachusetts, seems nervous, almost jittery, as he explains why he thinks everybody is getting the Democrats' problems wrong. I hear a lot, get a leader. Let's really get behind somebody. And I strongly disagree with that. Auchincloss told me, the forest of ambition is large. There's no shortage of presidential timber. And I'm worried about the ideas. This is what keeps Auchincloss up at night. It's that we are bereft of big ideas. Auchincloss has a few. He wants to offer free one-on-one tutoring to kids who are behind in school because of COVID-19. He wants to subsidize community health clinics and hold social media corporations accountable for what he calls the attention tracking of America's youth. But a decade of fighting MAGA, he says, has depleted some intellectual dynamism from his party. In 2028, we'd better be ready to have dynamic candidates on the stage of offering whole new ideas, he warns, or we'll lose again. In our conversation, Democrats often made that argument. It's not enough to say what we're against, they say. We have to say what we're for. But when I asked these same party insiders what that should be, most regurgitated ideas that Democrats have run on for decades. Protect Social Security and Medicare. Protect abortion rights. Protect labor. Okay, I'd say, what about new ideas? They mentioned their own pet projects, bill blocking, a supermarket merger, a bill addressing spending, veterans issues, a bill ensuring the right to fix your own car. Somehow, I had a hard time imagining permitting reform as a rallying cry capable of mobilizing millions of now low-information voters. I've heard some folks say, it's not our policies, we just have to communicate better, says Representative Angie Craig, who is running for an open Senate seat in Minnesota. It actually is our policies that swing state voters aren't with us on. For those colleagues who were calling to defund the police, our voters are not with you on that. Most Democrats now acknowledge that the progressive movement encouraged a kind of purity politics that hampered the party's ability to win major majorities. We swung the pendulum too far to the left, says Representative Rich Torres, who represents a Bronx district where Trump made inroads with working class people of color, as he did in cities around the country. We have to become more responsive to interest groups than to the people on the ground. Many Democratic officials believe the party moved too far left on social issues in particular. There are some sports where trans girls shouldn't be playing against biological girls, says one lawmaker, adding that most of his fellow Democrats agree, but are afraid. Of the blowback that comes from a very small community. Even abortion is up for a rethink. Some Democrats want a retreat from the enthusiastic embrace of abortion rights and a return to talking about abortion as safe, legal, and rare, as Bill Clinton put it. Refusing to say that, even in the third trimester, there's no limits on it. It's not where the average American is, says another Democratic lawmaker. The really embarrassing truth is Donald Trump is closer to the median on abortion than the Democrats were. Yet the fact that these lawmakers would share these thoughts only without their names attached shows how much Democrats still fear antagonizing their liberal base. Others insisted that the problem is one of emphasis. When Democrats spent so much time talking about other things, student debt, LGBTQ rights, police reform, climate change, voters decided they'd taken their eye off the ball. You've got to be principally seen worrying about jobs and people's pay and health care, economic issues, says Representative Chris DeLuzio, who represents a working-class district in western Pennsylvania. I think folks see too many Democrats as not caring principally about the economy. This theory might make more sense if Harris had run a 2024 campaign that was all about trans kids, abortion, and gun safety. Harris didn't run that campaign. She offered tax credits to boost small businesses, proposals to lower the cost of groceries and childcare, and the most comprehensive, affordable housing plan ever put forth by a presidential candidate. And she lost. Kamala Harris was talking about it, says Representative Greg Caesar of Texas, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, but nobody was hearing it. Senator Ruben Gallego met me outside the Senate gym, still slightly damp. Gallego, who was raised by an immigrant, single mother, and served in the Marine Corps, was a rare bright spot for his party last year. He outperformed Harris by 8 points in Arizona, handily won Latino men, and was one of only two Democrats to win Senate battleground spaces. As we walked through the Capitol, Gallego, 45, describes his very simple message. I'm here to bring you more security, economic security, and your personal family security. It meant talking constantly about the cost of living and taking a more hard-line stance on immigration than most of his Democratic peers. When we arrived at his hideaway, Gallego was so new to the Senate that he had forgotten his key. The freshman senator told me he didn't necessarily think other Democrats needed to adopt his security message. He just wants them to speak like normal people. The party's problem is bigger than bad messaging, he believes. The problem is caution. Democrats in general are always fearful of messing up, he said. The Democratic mindset has been to run very tight but not open campaigns. I knew what he was talking about. Aides on the Biden and Harris campaigns were very cautious. They'd often go off the record just to provide canned talking points. That approach, Gallego says, is self-defeating in the age of social media, where crafting the perfect soundbite can mean missing the moment altogether. I told my team during the campaign, this is a vibe election, says Gallego. If we can match the policy with creating this vibe, this culture, that's going to break through across all modes and mediums. His point was that the art of messaging has changed. It's less about developing the perfect slogan and more about authenticity, simplicity, and virility. The more consultified something sounds, the less memorable it is. Like Gallego, many moderate Democrats have particular critiques of this party's economic message. I think Democrats have made this mistake of saying, "I'm here to help the little guy." Nobody wants to be called the little guy, says Representative Marie Glusenkamp Perez, 36, who has won in a red district in Washington state. The fatal mistake in politics is condescension. She's not the only Democrat who thinks that the party erred by targeting its messaging to the most marginalized rather than the vast, struggling middle class. Nearly 70% of voters in battleground districts think that Democrats are too focused on being politically correct, according to a brutal internal polling shared with top party leaders in March, while a majority think that Democrats are not looking out for working people and are more focused on helping other people rather than people like me. The focus on protecting the most vulnerable, in other words, has left many Americans feeling ignored. I constantly get draft matters in my office that say things like, "Democrats are fighting so you can put food on the table." That's not aspirational, says Mallory McMorrow, a Michigan state senator now running for U.S. Senate. To McMorrow, the Democrat message should be simple, universal, and optimistic. Democrats fight for the American dream, she says. Others believe that the party has to emphasize a more populist pitch to counter Trump's. The Democratic Party needs to make as our central message that our goal is to break the unholy alliance between corporate greed and corrupt government, Sazer told me. If somebody is more conservative than me on this social issue, we may disagree on this foreign policy issue. At the end of the day, people say that the Democratic Party puts me first and the billionaires last, and that's what wins. One of the things that surprised me over the course of these conversations was the way a Sanders-style economic populist had gained traction with politicians not normally associated with the Sanders wing of the party. "The economy is rigged because our government is rigged," Chris Murphy told me. "Democrats," he added, "have to wake up every morning thinking about how to unrig our government so that the corporations and the billionaires don't always get what they want." This was a man who stumped so hard for Hillary Clinton in 2016 that he was on a short list to be VP. "I think it was a huge mistake for our party to view Bernie as a fringe threat to the party," he says now. Bernie's message all along has been the crossover message, the message that appeals both to Democrats and also to a big element of Trump's base. 5 months ago, Kat Abuzaglai was an online journalist and researcher who made vital takedowns of far-right figures. But when she saw Democrats clapping politely during Trump's second inauguration, something snapped. "It was just so pathetic," she told me, speaking on the phone from her home office in the Chicago suburbs. "I was like, well, maybe they'll actually do something." And then they didn't. Shortly afterward, Azubala, 26, announced a primary challenge to Republican Representative Jan Schlichowski, an 80-year-old party stalwart who has served in Congress since the year that Abasolov was born. Schakowsky wasn't the worst member of Congress, Abasolov thought. They agreed on a lot of issues, but Abasolov thought Schakowsky wasn't up to the moment. Her campaign announcement video asked a simple question: what if we didn't suck? She raised more money in the campaign's first week than Schakowsky did the entire first quarter. Within 6 weeks, Schakowsky announced that she would not seek re-election. Even if the Democrats generate new policy ideas and adopt a sharper pitch, they'll still bump up against the core issue that tanked Biden, Harris, and much of the rest of the party last year: age. Many Democrats are finally realizing that too many of their leaders are too established, too out of touch, or simply too old to connect with voters. 4 House Democrats died in office over the past year. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries has acknowledged that Republicans could not have passed a budget solution in April had their narrow majority not been widened by the deaths of 2 members of his own caucus. Of the 30 House Democrats who are 75 or older, more than half told Axios they plan to run for re-election next year. Many Democrats are not eager only for generational change. They want to change the top of the party as well. Some see Jeffries and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer as too deferential to established norms or too reluctant to use procedural powers to slow down Trump's agenda. Both are underwater in public opinion polls. Only 27% of Americans approve of congressional Democrats overall, the lowest number since CNN started asking in 2008. I think the party is hyper-focused on message and forgetting the messenger, says Amanda Lipman, the co-founder of Run for Something, which recruits new Democrats to run for office and supports them with training, mentorship, and campaign tools. They've missed the way that people consume information. You look for a person, not an institution. A sclerotic party establishment has created a culture of waiting your turn. All the people that are in formal leadership roles, says Pat Ryan, are ladder climbers, not leaders. At the DNC, Martin has locked horns with the party's new vice chair, David Hogg, a survivor of the 2018 Parkland school shooting, who rose to national prominence as a gun safety activist. Hogg's political organization, Leaders We Deserve, plans to invest $20 million to support young candidates challenging asleep-at-the-wheel Democrats in safe seats. Hogg tells me that the party's post-Biden realignment isn't primarily about ideology. It's, did you want to fight, or do you want to roll over and die? Martin has publicly rebuked Hogg, insisting that the DNC maintain its long-standing position of neutrality. On May 12th, the DNC's Credentials Committee voted to void the elections of Hogg and another party official for procedural reasons that they say predated the controversy, setting up the prospect of Hogg's losing his position. In the meantime, a new breed of Democrat is stepping up. They're younger, more digitally fluent, more working class. They speak American without a D.C. accent. People who haven't been politicians for 30 years can go into a non-political space and be a real person, Amanda Lipman told me as she walked to pick up her children from daycare. These new candidates can talk persuasively about the cost of housing and childcare, issues that probably haven't affected your life much if you've been in Congress since 1995. It's not the magic words, says Lippman. It's that so many of these people can't be credible messengers. Some new ones may emerge from the younger generation of Democrats who were elected in the 2018 wave after Trump's first victory and are now running statewide. Mallory McMorrow, 38, and Haley Stevens, 41, are vying for Michigan's open Senate seat. Angie Craig, 53, is running for Senate in Minnesota. Abigail Spanberger, 45, is running for governor of Virginia. Representative Mikey Sherrill, 53, is running for governor of New Jersey. The fight is generational, Sherrill says. As soon as she arrived in Congress in 2019, she told me she encountered an entrenched cohort of collegial lawmakers who refused to update their strategy playbook because they kept waiting for politics to go back to the chummy inside game that it had been pre-2016. Do I think we need a new generation of leaders? Yes, she told me. But guess what? I think we're about to get it. When Greg Caesar arrived at the Tucson rally for Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez's Fighting Oligarchy tour, the line of spectators stretched so long that Caesar's Uber driver thought that he was going to a concert, and organizers had expected 2,000 people at a high school gymnasium. He said more than 10 times that many showed up. People are even more opposed to what Donald Trump is doing than 8 years ago, Caesar told me, fiddling with his AirPods as he sat outside a committee markup in late April. But they want a new kind of leadership from the Democratic Party. As party leaders in Washington debate how to move forward, their grassroots base is sick of waiting for them to figure it out. Frustrated liberals have founded roughly 1,400 local indivisible groups since the election, including more than 600 in GOP congressional districts. More than 46,000 young people have signed up to run for office through Run for Something since November. To those who participated in the resistance movements of the first Trump term, the grassroots rage feels different this time. It's not just targeted at Trump. It's also focused on the feeble Democrats and spineless institutions that have failed to effectively resist him. Some Democratic officials have responded by copying Trump's own playbook. They're favoring non-political podcasts over cable studios, burnishing their social media game, showing up at football games and Coachella. They're trying to worry less about who they're offending and more about who they're reaching. Group chats of Democratic lawmakers are full of delicate negotiations on how best to respond to the Trump presidency. We recognize that the most important thing we can do is make this guy unpopular, says one lawmaker. They're sharing talking points and legal strategies while weighing various acts of defiance against the potential for distraction. Internal discussions, says this lawmaker, are laser-focused on figuring out what's tactically smarter. Most Democrats expect public outcry against Trump's policies will help them retake the House in 2026. Winning back the Senate will be tougher, with more Democrats on defense in battleground states. In the meantime, a shadow presidential primary is already taking shape, with hopefully drawing different lessons from Trump's win and its aftermath. California Governor Gavin Newsom has started a podcast featuring Trump's allies like Steve Bannon and Charlie Kirk as guests, and pivoted to the center in his day job, cracking down on homeless encampments and pushing to reduce health care benefits for undocumented immigrants. Barnstorming against oligarchy helped Ocasio-Cortez raise $6 million in the first quarter of the year, rekindling speculation about her viability as a candidate for higher office. Cory Booker's marathon senator speech protesting Elon Musk cuts to the federal government was liked more than 350 million times on TikTok. And Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker rallied against do-nothing Democrats in a speech in New Hampshire. As Pritzker put it, the reckoning is finally here. Democrats are coming around to a new mantra. Winning the argument is less important than winning elections. If the path to victory means embracing economic populism, they'll do it. If they have to make room for new faces, then sayonara, old friends. If they need to tack to the center on some social issues, so be it. If winning requires doing more podcasts or embracing Instagram influencers or campaigning on permitting reform, they'll give it a try. Because now that Democrats have seen what a second Trump presidency looks like, they're relearning the lesson they should have learned all along. Only winning is winning. Folks, that's our cover story for today. And you're listening to Sun Sounds, week one of Time Magazine, cover stories and feature stories. And our next feature story is The Shift East. China, an auto underdog, is the electric vehicle boom, which now powers its tech rise. At NIO's design workshop in suburban Shanghai, engineers spread billets of clay onto an aluminum frame of a basic car. A robotic arm with a mechanized drill then carves a series of grooves into the clay corresponding to a designer's sketch. The rough surface is then painstakingly smoothed with palette knives before aluminum foil is pasted on top. Finally, the sleek-looking metallic model is rolled into a sunlit courtyard where every curve and camber is scrutinized. The artistry really happens with these guys putting color on, taking it off, putting more clay on, taking it off, says Colin Phipps, Senior Director of NIO Shanghai Design, who previously worked 12 years for Cadillac. This is a very labor-intensive process. It's also an incongruously artisanal first step of a design method that is otherwise steeped in pushing technological boundaries. Since its founding in 2014, NIO has notched 9,800 global patents, most impressively popularizing battery swapping technology that allows customers to change their drained battery for a fully charged one in just 3 minutes in over 3,000 swap stations across China and Europe. NIO also produces the world's longest range electric vehicle, EV, battery capable of over 650 miles, 1,000 kilometers, on a single charge. Tesla's record is 402 miles. It has the world's only dual display windshield, projecting data at two separate perspectives directly in the driver's line of sight, and the first homologated drive-by-wire system, which guides the wheels without physical steering. NIO's EP9 sports car was, upon launch in 2016, the world's fastest EV, breaking 194 miles per hour and breaking records at Germany's famous Nürburgring-Nordisk circuit. Innovation creates value, NIO CEO William Lee tells Time, and innovation helps us survive amid a fierce competition, be it in China or worldwide. NIO is just one of an alphabet soup of Chinese brands, from AION, BYD, and Clever, to Maxus, Netta, Anvo, to Xiaoping, Yangwang, and Zeekr, dominating the global EV market today. It's been a meteoric rise. In 2001, China had fewer than 10 million passenger vehicles for its 1.2 billion population. That's just one vehicle for every 128 people, or a market penetration equivalent to America's in 1911. 3 years after, Henry Ford produced his first Model T. But by 2009, China was the largest car maker in the world. From being a net car importer as recently as 2020, China today sends more vehicles overseas than any other nation. Its passenger car exports jumped nearly 20% in 2024 to 4.9 million. Meanwhile, imports of cars to China dropped from a peak of 1.24 million in 2017 to just 705,000 last year. Chinese automakers are eager to account for a third of the global market by 2030, according to Alex Partners. When it comes to EVs, China already accounts for nearly two-thirds of global sales. NIOs are currently sold in six European nations as well as Israel and the UAE. BYD, meanwhile, is now undisputedly the world's top EV firm, present in only 70 countries and outselling Tesla globally for a second straight quarter. While Tesla delivered 336,681 vehicles worldwide for the January to March period, down 13% year-on-year, BYD delivered 416,388, up 38%. Americans remain largely unaware of all of this. Under President Biden, a tariff of 100% was slapped on Chinese EVs, and President Trump added an additional 25% on all foreign cars. This has negative consequences for EV adoption in the self-styled spiritual home of the automobile, where half of Americans are interested in going electric, according to recent polls. It also impacts the global fight against climate change. Consumers in the U.S. could drive better cars, consume less gasoline, less on maintenance, and that would also be good for climate change, says Paul Gong, head of China's auto research at UBS Investment Bank. There is a certain pity that because of tariff protectionism, the world is not as green and not as prosperous. Still, some very real concerns lie behind import barriers. The U.S. and allies accuse China's industrial policies of massive subsidies that cause overcapacity crowds, and they out-competition Chinese government support in its EV industry, cumulatively totaled $230.9 billion from 2009 to 2023, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, a bipartisan D.C. think tank. Last July, the EU also imposed a provisional subsidy tariff of up to 37.6% on Chinese EVs, promoting Beijing to hike tariffs on European pork and brandy in retaliation in August. Canada hiked its import tariff on Chinese EVs to 100%. However, to simply blame state subsidies for China's mastery of EVs is reductive. Time and again, whether it's smartphones, solar panels, or SG, China is combining state support with economies of scale and a fiercely competitive domestic market to command transformative technologies. Strong supply chains leverage high-quality, low-cost components to ascendancy in EVs and provides a window into the future tussles between the world's top two economies over innovative sets to power the fourth industrial revolution. The risk for the United States is that these advantages will soon also allow China to dominate industries such as generative AI, quantitative computing, and humanoid robotics, and EVs are front and center to these goals. These are much more than just battery-powered vehicles, says Ilaria Montezuco, a senior fellow focused on Chinese business and economics at CSIS. The technology shift involves a form of data processing, more AI integrated into the system, and synergies that provide pathways to advance in other technologies. China's rise didn't initially make the West uncomfortable. Far from it. China's peerless manufacturing efficiency reaped billions of dollars for U.S. firms. The fact that an ostensibly communist nation was trying its hand at capitalism was thought endearing, even quaint, not to mention proof that liberal economic theory had won the day. The country, after all, presented giant and growing markets for American industry, until China began to pull ahead. Though it welcomed McDonald's and Starbucks and encouraged its brightest to hone their minds at Western universities, Beijing maintained a strict hold over the economy while cannily acquiring foreign expertise. Today, China accounts for 27.5% of all global auto sales, more than the next three countries, the U.S., India, and Japan, combined. China's government facilitated this rise by allowing foreign auto firms to enter the Chinese market only with a domestic partner, as well as what might be called resourceful harvesting of intellectual property. It was good old-fashioned protectionism. And for China, it worked. Chinese companies are poaching engineers and executives from storied European and American manufacturers while buying up foreign competitors wholesale. Ford sold Swedish firm Volvo to China's Geely for $1.8 billion in 2010. In 2017, Geely also bought storied British sports car firm Lotus. 10 or 15 years ago, products in China weren't competing globally, to put it mildly, says Dan Balmer, Lotus president and CEO for European, Asia, Pacific, Middle East, and Africa. But you could see the energy, the enthusiasm, the investment into the industry. So they've learned very well, and they're now leading in many fields. Lotus now retains a design and production facility in the UK, but all its electric and MREV EVs are made in Wuhan, best known as the epicenter of COVID-19, where a $1.1 billion plant opened in 2022 can turn out 150,000 vehicles a year. Before, people were coming to China just to have better access to the Chinese market, says Frank Bournois, dean of the China European International Business School in Shanghai. Now you come to China to improve your processes, and AI is really pushing that forward. U.S. policymakers have had a hard time squaring this new paradigm, as evidenced by Vice President J.D. Vance's complaints to Fox News in early April that we borrow money from Chinese peasants to buy the things those Chinese peasants manufacture. But whereas the first generation of Chinese entrepreneurs grew up poor and were happy to wring a livelihood from cheap limitations, today's tech graduates were spared the privations of their parents and yearned for something more meaningful. Before, Chinese people were happy to copy others just so they wouldn't go hungry, says Grace Shan, a former AI manufacturer turned IT consultant, who publishes the AI Prome newsletter. Now they seek a sense of mission. While Washington attributes China's recent successes to subsidies, that's only part of the story. When the Beijing central government can pinpoint an industry to prioritize, city and provincial governments immediately offer incentives in the desperate race to seed a local champion. This flood of liquidity generates a bubble that artificially inflates values and encourages other big players to enter the market. But in 2020, the leading government-supported EV maker in China was Tesla, whose consumers received $325 million in tax rebates, as well as $82 million in grants to construct its Shanghai Gigafactory. Meanwhile, at its peak in January 2021, NIO's market cap was $96.57 billion, or double that of General Motors. Competition between regions and manufacturers is remorseless. In 2023, some 52,000 EV-related companies shut down in China. As the bubble burst, NIO's worth has plunged to just $7.53 billion, despite shipping a record of 221,970 cars last year. But those firms that emerged unscathed are lean and technologically agile and infused with the necessary moxie to thrive. It's not all positive for China, of course. The nation faces myriad economic challenges, including deflation, local governments drowning in debt, poor consumer spending, plummeting real estate values, record youth unemployment, and a demographic time bomb. China's regulatory framework, and especially its draconian rules regarding data transfers, are anathema to foreign partners. In September, the European Chamber of Commerce in China released a position paper that made over 1,000 recommendations for how to improve the business environment. Then, there's the as-yet-unknown effect of a trade war with the U.S., where China last year sent 14.7% of exports worth $438.9 billion. But as America walls itself off, China also has a golden opportunity to reset trade relations with the rest of the world. In mid-April, after Trump's global tariff onslaught, President Xi Jinping remarked on a charm offensive in Southeast Asia, declaring that a trade war has no winners and that protectionism leads nowhere. Just export controls have spurred domestic innovation. A U.S. waged trade war only puts Chinese firms in a more favorable light. The bar is low in terms of looking like a more reliable and constructive partner than the United States these days, says Mazzocco of CSIS. Well, you've been here before. The U.K. became the world's biggest economic superpower in the 18th and 19th centuries through its first mover advantage in industrialization. But the U.S. adopted these technologies and, via its largest market, and manufacturing capabilities soon became the global leader in both innovations and their commercialization. The question is whether the U.S. can survive a trade war that threatens to drastically diminish its markets while simultaneously undermining the development of core technologies by defunding universities and research institutions. China already produces twice as many highly cited AI research publications as the U.S. According to a recent report from the D.C.-based Information Technology and Industry Foundation, China is near the lead of innovation or better in 6 out of 10 industries of the future. If EVs are any augury, America's days at technology's vanguard might be numbered. "We believe the Chinese market has the best talent," says Lee. "Every year, there are several million new science and technology graduates, and they, like their government, are determined to seize the day." And folks, that does it for Time Magazine for today. That is our two stories, the cover story and the feature story. And we will look forward to reading next week The View and The Brief and the Time 100 Philanthropists. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.